conference record has joined the conference.
Correct.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone on? Are we on?
I'm on the call. You're on the call too and can't hear anything?
Correct.
I don't know what's going on.
This is Steve Knight. I'm also on the call.
Okay.
We've got a trio. Can we pick a tone?
Maybe they forgot us.
I have no idea what's going on. I mean, obviously the system isn't working.
I'm wondering if they muted us.
Caleb, is that you?
I'm not sure. There's a number. I don't have my cell phone, but there's a number that was to use to arrange this. Does anybody have another phone that we might contact the Albany? Not really.
I have a cell phone, and I could quickly email that.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Hi, folks. This is Rudy Lewis in the Department of Health, and I just asked my secretary to check with Eduardo, who I guess is Karen Westervelt's secretary, to make sure we have the correct call-in information. I think there was some I'm not sure whether this call was supposed to start at 10 or 10:30. I think the original indication was 10:30, so it just may be that it's starting at that time instead of 10 o'clock.
For those on the line, we're just running a little late getting started, so we're on mute in the conference room until it does.
We're in?
You're all in.
Yep.
This morning.
And for anyone on the call, so if you may be getting started, and we're keeping the phone on mute in the conference room until it starts.
We asked everyone to please make sure you use the microphones because we have folks that are on audio, the only way they'll be able to keep up with the meeting is that we're using the microphone. Also, they're in the back there taking lunch orders. They ask that you put your order in by 10:30 if you would like to order lunch. We have a lot of discussion. We try to delay on them because of the weather. It seems like some folks are having problems getting in. And before I hand it over to my co-chair, Bill, I also would like to tell you that I think this meeting is at least exciting as a good novel. But if I should lose control, well, let me just say I'm operating on 2.5 hours of sleep, so I apologize if that catches up with me. I'm unable to contain myself. I don't think that's likely to happen, but I think you deserve an explanation why. If it does, it's a pleasure now to turn over the meeting to my co-chair, Dr. Bill.
Thank you, George. Also, just want to mention to always be careful with your microphone is on because, you know, that will be recorded and can be heard. So if you're going to have any private conversations, make sure, you know, your microphone is not on. First of all, I want to thank everyone for participating in this process. It's been pretty interesting to me, and I'm, you know, hopeful that you know, we can go forward and come out with some good products at the end. So I guess we should just start by going around and introducing ourselves, and then we'll also introduce the MRT members who may be online as well. So as George said, I'm Bill Evanstein. I'm the University Dean of Health at the University of New York.
Let me grab this one. Hi. I'm Henry Fernandez. I'm the Associate Commissioner with the New York State Office of Mental Health. I'm here representing Michael Hogan, who's the Commissioner of the Office of Mental Health.
I'm Assembly Member Richard Gottfried. I chair the Health Committee in the New York State Assembly.
I'm Robert Hughes, Medical Society, State of New York.
Bruce McIvory, Lead of Voluntary Hospitals.
Brian O'Malley, Consumer Direct and Personal Assistance University of New York.
Is your mic on, Debbie?
Get a green light.
Debbie King, Executive Director of 1199. I'm trying to represent 500 employers and about 200 folks who work in the United States.
Good morning, I'm Fred Heigl from the Healthcare Association.
Good morning, Bill Stackhouse from the Community Healthcare Association of New York State.
Hello, Tania Valencia from 13th New York with Loretta.
Tim Johnson from the Greater New York Hospital Association. David Jackson, New York City Society of Physician Assistants.
Doug Wilson, the Health Care Center. Mary Ann Edwards,
Department of Health.
Jay Thompson, Department of Health.
Caleb Lister, Department of Health.
Sarah Gray, Department of Health.
$11.99. Karen Westervelt, Department of Health.
Yes, and for do we have any members of the work group on the conference call? Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, this is Karen Coleman from the New York State Department of Labor, acting Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Development.
Okay. Anyone else?
Kathy Preston, Associate Vice Chancellor of Health Affairs at SUNY, not to be confused with Jane Preston.
This is Tom Curran, a member of the Chemung County Board of Health, a member of the subcommittee.
Okay.
Steve Knight, United Helpers.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. So, again, thank you all for participating. I guess we should start by just quickly going over the agenda for today. And we're going to start out with Karen giving us an overview of the, I don't know if I can say this word very well, I've been trying to get it down, prioritization process. I don't know why. Does anybody else have trouble with that? Well, a priority process, I guess, we're going to go through here. And I think that'll be, you'll find that very interesting. This is a very interesting instrument that the MRT group has used before. Then we're going to have a report out on the results of the non-licensed worker subgroup, discussion of the proposals and priorities, lunch break, the report out on the licensed professional subgroup, and discussion of adoption of charge and next steps. One thing you know, I'll say in a little bit in advance of the proposals is here really, you know, it's the presentation of the proposals isn't meant to get into serious debate. We have a very short timeline. We have a number of proposals and so on. Really what it is a presentation of the proposals. In the subgroups, we've had debates and discussions that have been quite lively. Here, I think one of the main jobs is to present the proposals to the broader group, especially those who were not in the subgroup, who may not be aware of it at all, or in the other subgroup, because these proposals will be going through, unless something, you know, extraordinary happens today, to this prioritization process, which we'll hear a little bit more about. So let me, I will tell you a little bit more of the rules of the game, you might say, in the presentation of the proposals, you know, when we come to that point. But let me turn it over now to Karen to describe this process of prioritizing.
I'll try to make this as painless as possible. This basically, with the consent of the chairs, and similar to the method that was used for the full MRT and many of the work groups, who all had competing proposals. Many were meritorious, but tried to figure out how they were going to get to the prioritization process. We used a modified Delphi tool. So what we're proposing to do is once we kind of have a sense of what the work group's priority proposals are going to be this afternoon, is literally on Friday is send out a survey instrument to the members, and we just need to talk a little bit about the metrics in that proposal that were going to be used. And then ask the members by COB Tuesday the 1st to get that information back to us so we can compile it. And prior to the November 7th meeting, we can try to get some information out to you and or at the meeting on the 7th, you know, make sure that we can use that as a framework for our prioritization and final decision making. But I wanted to talk a little bit just about the proposed metrics and make sure that it meets with what you guys think would be sufficient for this particular work group. I had staffed the health disparities work group, and they had chosen to change one metric to have added emphasis on health disparities, for example. But what we're proposing right now, the first metric is relates to cost. So what's the financial impact of this proposal? Because, you know, we have to remember that these proposals are being viewed through the lens of the Medicaid program. So what's the cost to the program? The next metric would be quality. So basically, you know, what improved health outcomes are we going to realize from this proposal? What benefits and risks are included in this proposal? The third metrics would be efficiency, you know, or ease of implementation. And the fourth metrics would be overall impact, you know, on the impacted population. So just to drill down just for a moment on cost, for example, you know, there's a scoring mechanism. So a minus one, for example, would mean that it will cost money in the next fiscal year and should be scored as a negative one. And these instructions are going to come with the instrument as well as the respective proposals that you're going to be rating as well. So a zero would be proposals that are cost neutral and should be scored zero. Then proposals that would save up to $10 million would be scored as a one. Proposals that would save between $10 million and $50 million would be scored as a two. And proposals that would save over $50 million would be scored as a three. So that's on the cost metrics. On the quality metrics, using a similar, you know, a similar scale, if you will, proposals that would decrease the quality of care would be a negative one. Proposals that would have no effect on quality would be a zero, whereas proposals that will slightly improve quality would be scored as a one. Proposals that will create infrastructure to support quality should be scored as a two. And proposals that create systems to improve quality will significantly improve quality care should be scored as a three. So, again, this is going to come out with a survey instrument, but I think we just wanted to make sure that we had consensus on the four respective metrics that are being used. And, again, the full MRT had used this to rank 4,000 proposals. I know the Health Disparity just used this as many of the other work groups, and it did help frame the decision-making.
Are there any questions or comments? The one comment I make is that as you get together your proposals to make sure that some of these items are addressed as carefully as possible, because people will have your proposals to look at, and to the degree that you address these, it'll give them more information, you know, to score it on some of these items. So I would just keep that in mind.
And one thing I should mention, too, is in front of you is the instruction, so because I know it sounds very technical. The instructions are also before you just for reference, as well as, you know, a blank spreadsheet that would be used. So this would be coming to you in a spreadsheet format and then be being returned back to, you know, Eduardo Santana in my office so that we can have the statisticians that do this for a living compile and aggregate the results.
I have a question. So along with the survey instrument, would we then send out, like, the full slate of official proposals for whatever they are at that time, because there have probably been different versions that have been passed around as they've been developed. We're still getting some in. We haven't even got some folks are on the road, and you know, we haven't even seen some of them yet. So when this is going to go out on
tomorrow.
So really, the proposals are really still one can consider them still drafts because they're whatever stage they're at now. They may be further refined, you know, as we go forward, but the point is really that at the point that this goes out, the proposals that are in are the ones that are going to be sent out, and those will be the ones that you'd reference in terms of your scoring, okay?
Correct. And what this also does is enable the group to rank the proposal so we can see where the priorities would be of this work group as well, because they're going to have, you know, there's finite recommendations that you're going to be able to advance, so that also helps in that way.
So am I correct then? So when this all gets processed through this mechanism, it would come out with a list of, based on the input of, I assume, Delphi versus Delphic Oracle, that means that we're all very wise men and women around here. Is that, we're like, okay, so once the wise men and wise women give their, rank these things in these terms of these categories, we would end up with proposal number one with the highest rank and so forth down the line.
Correct, and it would be aggregated based on the different categories. So we would give you the overall,
mm-hmm.
the overall aggregate totals, as well as ranked by the different quality
right now,
metrics
see,
as well, or four metrics.
So then that that information would help inform the final decision or the meeting on the 7th, where we really are putting forward recommendations and so on. So. That's right. Okay.
Correct.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
Just Karen, I think that on some of these, I don't know whether or not there have been studies about what the cost savings would be. So, you know, I assume we have to kind of just make some type of an estimate, and will, you know, DOH staff be looking at this? For example, if different people score that it's worth X.
No, that's a good point.
How will you determine what?
You know, you have to do your best guess. Because what we're going to be doing, once we know what proposals, you know, most likely you're looking to advance, our OHIP staff will start looking at trying to cost these out And that'll be, you know, to the extent that we can get that information before the 7th, that'll be in your final proposal packages.
Bob?
Are we still accepting new proposals at this time?
We, as far as this meeting goes, I would say no more new ones presented today that we haven't seen or are somehow on the way or that we expect. We were just talking about that before. I would say, you know, my view would be in the view of keeping sort of an open process. And there are some even proposals of the 87 or whatever the number was that didn't maybe get the full airing and so on. So I'd say keep the process open, not for this round. I guess try to deal with it on a case-by-case basis. I don't know if that's, you know, if other people have another view of that. But
the only concern that I would have is we just need to be aware that time is very short. We have to have a final product by November 7th so that staff has time to submit the final package by November 15th. So we just need to just make sure that the group takes a look. Is it something that's compelling or not? You know, and because there's not going to be a lot of time to have substantive dialogue around it.
Thank you.
I have a similar question. If at today's meeting somebody has a suggestion for modifying a proposal, is there a way for such a suggestion at this stage in the process to be incorporated into a recommendation?
The way I would take that, because we've had, you know, people have presented proposals, the proponents of the proposals, and they've heard feedback, and this is just one more opportunity to hear feedback. They may or may not incorporate into the proposal, them being the proponent, because we can't vote on, you know, each of the various little, you know, suggestions at this point. That would be, you know, probably not possible in this setting. So I would say, yes, they can be. Hopefully they would be. We had input, and the person who's the proposal writer hopefully will take that under consideration. If they don't, and it's an important item, so that may affect, you know, the end result. But that's how I would respond to that.
Well, would the work group as a whole have the opportunity to amend a proposal before approving it, as opposed to the subcommittee amending it?
Yes. I mean, I think that we're going to go through this process now, and then we'd have another meeting, and this would be with input and the prioritization process. At that last meeting, then, a proposal would be either recommended or have to be modified, or a decision will have to be made one way or another for the proposal. I would imagine that would be the time to do that if the comments have not been adopted before that time.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, I mean, one thing I have to say, I feel proud of with this group is even with the various, whatever the right word is, contention, you know, with some of the projects that that are on our, charge, is that it's been very open. No one's been prevented from putting forward a proposal and moving forward with it. So in spite of the fact that we know that it doesn't have, unanimous approval necessarily. Okay. George, you want to add anything before we move to Helen?
David Jackson, just one question. If advice is brought forward for recommendations for change, but we're voting on them tomorrow.
Right. So I would say this, we were just talking about it. It's going to go out tomorrow, and that will go out with it's still a draft because it still might be modified various times around the road. But if you hear something, David, for example, today, or someone makes a suggestion and you want to incorporate that into your proposal, make that change and send it in, and that's what will go out, you know, tomorrow.
When do you need that physically to be in to go out tomorrow?
You know, I think, if there's a sense of whether the proponent is willing to accept that amendment, we can try to put maybe a qualifier statement or something in the proposal saying that some language may be being modified in a certain regard so that we can do that in the staff level right away before we send it out tomorrow. Otherwise, we're moving our time frame even further and giving you less time to, you know, to be able to go through that instrument. So maybe we can just, as staff, put like a one-line kind of statement saying subject to modification or whatever the detail might have been on it.
As we all know, part of the problem is that our time frame has been so short here that we're turning everything around so quickly. And, you know, do you have some place to go tonight or early tomorrow? You can't get to make a change? I'm just teasing. That's just a joke. Sorry, bad joke. All right, so it'll either get in there or there'll be some qualifier, you know, that we can attach to it. But I think they all should be considered drafts because they may be modified along the way as we go, certainly on the last meeting as well. Okay, any other comments? I apologize. It is a slightly messy process, I guess, to a certain extent, but, you know, I think everyone's trying their best to move it forward in our time. Anyway, let me turn it over to Helen, and I heard I wasn't in that non-licensed trading credentialing subgroup, but evidently they had a love fest there, and I guess I didn't measure up on my side. But anyway, Helen, could you present or facilitate the presentation of proposals from your group?
Sure. We had a vigorous process to consider these proposals. We came up with, we did a lot of consolidation. I think the different groups had different kinds of proposals, really. A lot of our proposals were actually quite similar.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I forgot to say the ground rules.
Oh, go for it.
Okay. So for each proposal, we decided the maximum amount of time for both presentation and discussion would be 10 minutes. I hope we can be shorter than that. We have a lot of proposals to go through, so if we just add up the time and, you know, want to get out in a decent time, you know, that's necessary. As I said, luckily I won't have to keep the time. The Department of Health folks will keep the time and, you know, say time is up and finish your sentence and we'll just move on. So it's not meant to be rude or anything. It's just meant to move the process forward. And as I said, the folks in each of the subgroups have heard these proposals, they're presenting them, they've been discussed in each group. Some people who have not been in the subgroup or been in the other one may not have heard this at all. So it's really a first presentation. So it's almost really more for those folks as well. And, we want to keep, the conversation, informational points and questions and comments, but not really meant for a serious, vigorous debate given our time constraints. So those are the ground rules. Sorry, Helen. Go ahead.
So just a question, actually. So we have these five shorter-term proposals and then two long-term ones. Do you want me to present all of them? And are the two long-term ones, are we also going to do the discussion on them? Or?
Yeah, why don't you go with all of them?
Okay. So I guess I will just briefly present the long-term ones, and then people can jump in from the subcommittee if they want to add to that. And then I think I have one of the short-terms to present, and then there are other folks who will present the shorter-term ones. So the long-term proposals, these were things that we just did not feel were in enough development to be presented for immediate legislative action, even though I think the committee felt very strongly that these were very important issues that ought to be taken up very soon. They would just require a slightly longer process than this immediate next legislative session. So the first one was really looking at the
It would be helpful if you could tell us the identifying number.
I will.
Early in the presentation so we can be looking at it.
Sure. So the first one is really a series of proposals related to community health workers and care management career ladders. So that encompasses proposals.
Number?
Yeah, I'm doing it right now. 9, 15, 23, 41, and 85. Those were all related to that topic. So what?
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be annoying, but 9. I mean, I've got a stack here, not in any kind of order. 9, 15,
23,
yeah,
41, and 85.
And before I go looking for them, are they in this pile?
No, Helen. We should say that they're not.
Sure. So we did not do the proposal information sheets for the long-term proposals. We only did them for the short-term proposals. That was our instruction.
They're on the spreadsheet.
They're on the spreadsheet, but they're not on. We didn't do the proposal information sheet.
Could you just, again, give me the topic you're lumping these numbers
under? Sure. It's a community health worker care management. What we're calling the emerging community health worker care management field. So our recommendation as a group is that the state should convene a group to study this field, the emerging community health worker and care management field, and to make specific recommendations for implementation in perhaps in fall 2012 regarding training, certification, and career pathways for community health workers and related titles. It would include titles in the mental health field, such as parent advocate and peer wellness coach. And a key goal, our recommendation, is to maximize stackability of any credentials that were developed through that process. Did you want to add anything?
Yes, I think that we thought this was a very important area, but we didn't think that we could be ready in this short time frame, but it's something that we definitely think is a priority for us in New York State to work on.
Okay, any other comments? So this is one of the longer-term recommendations.
Okay. Are the items on the spreadsheet intentionally randomized in numerical order, or is there a method?
They were sorted by there are certain categories. If you see sort of the end of the sheet there, to licensed professional, and then which represented the proposals that were taken up by the licensed professional subgroup, and then the not licensed training and credentials subgroup, which is what Helen's reporting on, and then there was another group called Other, which the Department of Health focused on. So those are the categories that we used to establish the subgroups.
They are all together on the middle of page 2. All of these proposals are stacked in the middle of page 2. If I'm using the right tool.
Is it possible for me to get a copy of this, of my own?
You can have that. That's the next one.
Can it be emailed to me?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
I can tell you, if I could see it, I don't know what they gave you, but I can see how they sorted it.
Well, it's also, the reason I'd like it emailed is because, and preferably not as a PDF, because if you send me a PDF, there is no way I can enlarge the type so that a human can read it. If you send it to me as a Word document or a spreadsheet, I can manipulate it in ways that make it useful to me.
So that's, yeah, the Department of Health will do that.
Okay. I don't know whether I'm the only person who would like it in that format, so I can't speak for anyone else.
How was it sent out? Is it a Word document or?
No, spreadsheet.
A spreadsheet, okay. All right, so they'll be sent out to you.
Okay.
Okay. And I definitely see, again, how it could be a little confusing. We all had that, you know, it was sorted in different ways, so the numbers can be a little bit confusing.
No.
Is there anything else then on this longer-term proposal or recommendation? And, Helen?
Okay, so we had a second longer-term recommendation, which is based on proposal number 58, and that is to convene a group to study the training and roles of direct care workers across long-term care settings, evaluating whether workers are adequately prepared to participate in new, more patient-centered models of care. The group would make its recommendation for changes for implementation in fall of 2012, and again, a key goal would be to maximize the stackability of credentials.
Any comments? So I have a question about when we have a long-term recommendation and the work of this group, since the work of this group ends, I guess, by the end of the year. When we talk about this would be a long-term recommendation that's made to the full MRT, if it was accepted as a long-term recommendation, some provision would have to be made to convene such groups to discuss that. Is that the way it would work? Okay. All right. Any other comments about this?
Hi. This is Rudy Lewis with the State Department of Health. I'm connecting my conference call.
And with respect to the first recommendation, community health workers and convening a group.
We're having a little trouble hearing you. Let's try that again from the top. And
informed the committee that there has been a group that's been supported by the New York State Health Foundation that has been working on this topic for the past 2 years, and it's involved Community Health Worker Network of New York City. It's been supported by the Health Foundation in addition to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They have been working on training and credentialing and scope of practice and looking at financing options. So to the extent that, you know, this is a long-term recommendation that would involve other groups, it might be worthwhile to have those folks involved in that discussion.
Yeah, that's a good point. I know I'm on that, a member of that group as well, and I think several other members are as well. So good point, yeah. Anything else?
I'm sorry. I think that what we were talking about was something slightly different. I'm aware of what the community health worker organization is doing with funding from the New York State Health Foundation. I think, and Helen, correct me if I'm wrong, I think what we were talking about was looking at the emerging initiatives of the State Department of Health around patient-centered medical homes, health homes, and what the complement of different roles would be, not focusing on a particular title, but the role of nurses, the role of community health workers, yes, but a lot of other folks and how they work together. So it wasn't focused on just that title. But Helen, that's what I understood we were really looking at.
I think what I would say is that it includes that. So we want to look at the whole field, which would, I think, include both, you know, a community health worker as a title, a bunch of different related titles, and then how that title interacts with existing professionals.
And one of our important goals in phrasing it the way we did was to not recreate silos. That was...
Yeah. Right, exactly. So I think that we will focus on care coordination and patient navigation, but throughout, not just with one title.
And we are aware of the planning by the community health worker group and have available their materials.
Okay. Shall we move on then to are we ready for now the proposal? Yes.
This is Steve Knight. Does this proposal include med techs?
No. That's a separate. We looked at that in the short term recommendation. So the long term one
does not include med techs.
No.
Thank you.
Okay, Helen.
Okay, so like I said, we had five recommendations that we thought were actionable in the short term that we wanted to bring to the full group for discussion. So the first one is based on proposal number 2. And this you should have, Debbie, did you hand it out or not yet? Not yet. Debbie's going to hand out and, I guess, speak to this proposal, which is to articulate the personal care aide training to the home health aide training to the certified nursing assistant training to facilitate workers obtaining all of those credentials.
That it's really somewhat related to the changes that are taking place in our health system where we are likely to have the need to have people certified both as home health aides and as CNAs. It could be very visionary. It would be great to have someone be able to follow a patient in different settings. Now, this is one of the things that Penny from Loretto had really talked about in terms of improving quality. And right now, if you have either a home attendant, HHA, or CNA certification, the credential is not stackable. You need to go back to school in many cases to learn what you already know. So that's a cost. For example, in our program, we are training people who are HHAs to be CNAs, and it's costing over $2,000 a person, plus the time that they have to spend. So it would make sense to create certifications that provide for coordination and for what people already know, not to have to be relearned. So basically that is what this proposal is about, and we believe it's something that can be done fairly simply. I think it's something Department of Health has looked at over the years. I think there have been some task forces on this, and I think it's something that with the new care models, it's essential that we move.
Any other comments, questions?
Is there a reason why the department has not, if they've been thinking about this for a while, has something held the department back from just doing this already? And would it be helpful for us to know that reason?
Hi, I'm Barry Gray. I'm not an expert in this area. I don't work in long-term care, but my understanding is there was a work group formed around this type of articulation based in long-term care a couple of years ago. I'm not really familiar with the work they did on it.
Work group that did the home health aid training curriculum, but I don't know if they looked at the PCA. It wasn't directly involved. I don't know if they looked at the PCA. I don't know, Helen, were you familiar with that group? But there was a work group that looked at the home health aid training curriculum, but I wasn't directly involved, so I'm not sure if they looked at the PCAs or not.
Carol Rodat, who's in the room, probably is the person who knows the most about this. But my understanding is, even though there have been pieces looked at, the entire kind of articulating these three pieces has not yet happened. Is that right, Carol?
Carol, can you use the microphone? Sorry.
Quite frankly, there was opposition to stacking the credentials because at that point in time, there was wide diversity between the wages and benefits, so that there was a concern that workers would leave the home and community-based settings and move to better jobs. We have begun to address that problem, and we think that under the new reform, that there is a more universality for workers, that we want them to be able to move, and they want to move as well.
Thank you.
I believe that from what we were talking about in our work group, that in some cases it may not be that people are moving, but they need to have both of these certifications to do their job. So it's a very, very different setting than it was a number of years ago.
Okay, any other comments or questions? Okay, so this will be the first one that will be sent through the Delphi process. Helen, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to present the second one, which is a combination, and it's a long list of numbers, of proposals number 1, number 64, number 12, number 28, and number 67. And I'm going to pass out a description of the proposal information sheet. And those numbers are listed on it, so if you didn't write them down, they'll be on that. So this has really two concepts in it. One is that there should be the creation of an advanced home care aide certification, so something that requires additional training above the home health aide certification. So that there should be the certification created and outline of the minimum training and qualifications developed, and that our concept is that the training would not focus on specific tasks, but it would focus on accurate reporting, communication skills, problem solving, and developing the home care worker as a member of the healthcare team. And then linked to this proposal, those aides would be allowed to have an expanded range of tasks delegated to them by registered nurses. So I think as people know from the original presentation, right now we have a set of tasks that home health aides can always do and then a set of tasks that are permissible under special circumstances. And there is a very specific protocol that the nurse has to go through where they train the aide to do that task. One example, a common example, is finger sticks. So if a person needs to check their blood sugar, that's not something that an aide can help them do without this special circumstance. The nurse has to train that aide and make sure that they can do that task appropriately, and then that aide is allowed to do that task for that patient only. If they move to a different patient, they would have to be retrained and recertified to do that particular task. So what we're suggesting is with this advanced training that an expanded range of tasks could be assigned then to those aides under the same set of restrictions, meaning that the nurse has to certify that that aide with that client can perform that task safely. The AARP did a study recently and ranked New York kind of in the middle among states around nurse delegation, what they call nurse delegation. They really see that as a key indicator of support for family caregivers, because right now what happens is if the home care client needs a task that is not permitted, that an aide is not permitted to do, you know, basically one of three things happens. One is that a family member has to rush home and try to do it, which leads not only to a burden on them, but kind of inconsistent care. If they get caught at work, they can't come home to do it. The second is that it could be that that person is a long-term CHA patient and that the task is being performed by nurses. However, under the reform through MRT 90, the CHA patients are not going to be long-term anymore, and there is really not going to be a program that has the financial resources to pay for that number of nursing visits, since there's going to be capitation in all of the home care programs. And then the last possibility, which was found to be somewhat frequent in studies in New Jersey and in Washington, is that the aides are doing it kind of off-license, which happens, right? If there's, you know, this needs to be done, somebody asked them to do it. So what they found was that kind of legalizing this process and creating supervision really brought some practices under supervision that were previously being done without any sort of registered nurse supervision. So that would be our proposal.
Okay, any comments?
Yes. How does this, since we don't have a proposed bill language, how would this proposal specify the tasks, or who would do that?
So I think this is open for, you know, certainly input from the Department of Health on how it would happen, but our just basic review is that you could do very simple bill language that just allows for the possibility, and then the Department of Health could develop specific regs. It's essentially adding to what is now very developed as this matrix of permissible and non-permissible tasks. So that could be updated, which I believe was done, that's through regulation. Those tasks are not currently listed in statute.
Although the regulating of who can do what is within the scope of practice of a nurse is, I think, not within the authority of the health department, but rather state ed. The consumer-directed program in the education law, would this proposal in any way limit or apply to that, to home health aides working under the consumer-directed program?
So Brian can speak to that as well. What I would say is that, you know, there was a proposal on the table to essentially allow nurses to use the same exemption. So the Consumer Directed Program has an exemption from the Nurse Practice Act.
Yes.
That anybody directed by a consumer is not covered by the Nurse Practice Act. There was a proposal, you know, which was one of the ones we considered, to essentially allow nurses working for home care agencies to be covered under that exemption and therefore direct aides to do that. We felt like that was too broad an approach, and so this is a more narrow approach that does not exempt anybody from the Nurse Practice Act, but allow nurses to assign some of their tasks to an aide in these particular circumstances.
So under this proposal, the consumer-directed operation would change in any way or not change in any way?
No, Brian, do you want to speak to that?
Our understanding is the way this proposal was discussed in the meeting, the section of law that exempts consumer-directed from the Nurse Practice Act would not be touched in any way, and it would be done in another area. Therefore, it wouldn't actually affect consumer-directed in any specific way.
Okay, and I think my last question about this is that the consumer-directed program, for reasons which I assume I once understood but makes no sense to me now, is limited to home care recipients under Medicaid. Would this proposal be restricted to home health aides who are being paid by Medicaid or not?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Any other comments? Questions? Okay, so...
I just wanted to clarify, so that our proposal would not require a change in statute. Is that right?
Well, so this is something that we still have to investigate. The matrix of permissible and non-permissible activities does say that that the performance of what are listed as non-permissible activities would violate the education law. So we tried to find exactly how that would do, and we didn't find it. So I guess we need to figure out, does there need to be a line specifically allowing the delegation of these tasks? So I think that's up for further investigation.
Okay, any other comments? Okay, let's move to the next one.
Okay, so Catherine, I think it's this one. It is a combination of proposal 27, 40, and 66.
And you handed out the proposal information
sheet. I did. Mm-hmm. I handed it out as the meeting was starting.
Okay.
And so this, as Helen said, this is a proposal that combines 27, 40, and 66. And this proposal was permitted. It really builds on the proposal that Helen just outlined and is consistent and parallel with it in terms of its the goal it is trying to accomplish and the rationale and some of the supporting evidence that we're drawing on. But the specific purpose of this proposal would be to permit the advanced aides with supervision and training by a registered nurse to assist self-directing and non-self-directing consumers with routine pre-poured medications. There's a lot jammed into one sentence, so let me unpack it a little bit. This is something that would apply, that would not just be for Medicaid, so that we would want to, this could be something that would be for home health aides who are working in hospice situations, in managed long-term care, or also potentially in private pay situations. It would involve the agency identifying a consumer who they thought was appropriate, could be safely assisted in this way. It would require a registered nurse to provide specific training to a specific aide on the specific circumstances of that consumer, their chronic illnesses, their medication regimen. And again, we're saying routine. So this isn't for something that is a fragile situation, a rapidly changing situation. This is something where there's stability. And it would require the registered nurse to provide specific training for the aide to demonstrate specific competencies, and then there would be ongoing monitoring and supervision on the part of the nurse. Built into this also, because we're building it off of the advanced aide training, we're building into this the additional work on bringing the aide into the care team, into the communication among the care team members, the more frequent contact, frankly, than just the sort of periodic in-home visits, so that we're building a stronger infrastructure of nursing supervision and support for this activity to happen. We are building off of experience in other states. This isn't something that we cooked up on our own, but there have been two pilots that have been going on in New Jersey and in Washington State. And what has come out in the evaluations of those pilots is reinforcing our sense of what we thought was probably going on, but it's been a little difficult to put your finger on it, that in fact, when this kind of need exists, sometimes it's actually dealt with a daily nursing visit, which is, you know, through the certified home health agency, a very expensive way to go. And as Helen described with the other MRT changes, not a service delivery option that's actually going to be available to us very much longer. And even when it was available, when it was something that could be paid for, those were difficult service orders, so to speak, to fill. And so there was definitely a barrier to care in that regard. The alternatives were people going to the gray market where it was completely unsupervised, and or families making informal arrangements with the paid workers. So it was, again, on the gray market, there's no licensing or supervision or training or anything. On the informal arrangements, there's some agency involvement, not training specific to, and monitoring specific to this task and this activity. So again, we, from those other pilots, what they found was you're bringing it in from the unsupervised territory, you're giving it structure and careful monitoring, and your result is not bad outcomes. Your result is more consistency and higher quality. And that those were the findings from the experiments that have already been going on. But Helen, do you want to add?
Questions, comments.
In the consumer-directed law, the director can be not only a consumer, but also a family member. Would that be included here as well?
Family members can already, I believe family members can already perform this task. And
no, I'm sorry. I don't mean as a performer of the task.
Oh, as the
but
director.
As the director. In the consumer-directed law, if you've got a consumer who is completely uncommunicative, but a family member who can direct the home health aide, that's covered by the statute.
But so
would a family member be able to fill the consumer director role under what you've just described?
My understanding is that right now the criteria for the aide being able to do it is that the client is self-directing. And so if there's no person there directing the care, then the aid is not permitted to do it outside of the consumer-directed program. So unless the person was in the house, I think, is the question. If they're not in the house, then the aid could not do the task.
Under the consumer-directed law, it is not limited to consumer-directed. It is consumer or
family
member
right.
directed.
Right.
I don't think the law is written in a way that says the directing family member has to be in the dwelling while the service is being provided.
Correct, not in that program. But these proposals would only affect people who are not in the consumer-directed program, which, you know,
I understand that. My question is, if the consumer is not an appropriate consumer, as that term was used in describing this proposal, does the proposal contemplate that an appropriate family member would do whatever you're proposing that the appropriate consumer do?
I think we should go back and look at it.
And if not, why not?
I think we should go back and look at it. Right. I know that families now can do, there can be a family employed substitute who the family is supervising to do this. So that would suggest that a family couldn't, under current practice, provide the supervision, so we should go back and look at that, right?
Correct. And then I think what you pointed out in your paper is that a high percentage, particularly in New York, of the non-self-directing clients, you know, older people with dementia, I think largely do not have family members that are involved in their care.
But we should look at this issue for the ones who do.
But many do, and there will be occasions every day when that family member cannot be physically present when the medication needs to be given.
Right.
And so the fact that the family member can give the medication is of no value
right.
to that consumer.
Right.
All right, so it sounds like you need to go back and look at this this point and either modify the proposal or, you know,
okay.
address it in some way.
Okay.
I think that's a good example of the kind of way we still can have, not to say there can't be further modifications down the road, but this forum can, let's say, improve the proposals that way or correct something. Tina.
One of the other areas, if I understand it, Catherine, as you presented it, the RN now would be liable for the care that was provided by the aide, because in the consumer directed, it is the consumer who is responsible for the care if anything goes wrong or whatever. So in this case, it would be the RN who would be liable if there were issues. Has there been any conversation or discussion about the number of aides that the RN would be responsible so that it would be safe?
That isn't something that we've talked about. We do say that the protocols for the training and the supervision would need to be developed and approved by the department. So I would certainly expect that something like that could be part of the protocol. Should be part of the protocol.
Okay. Any other comments? These are very good comments.
I would say that the RN isn't really liable. I think the responsibility with the RN.
Speaking to the mic a little closer,
Thank you. I think the responsibility of the RN, as we propose it, is in the training and supervision that the person, the aide, has been appropriately trained. So if they can't be in the room, they will not be with the aide.
I would differ with that interpretation. If an RN assigns a task to an aide, they have to make sure that the aide is qualified and competent to do that, and if there is an error, the RN will be called into question as to whether or not they assured that the aide was qualified and competent to do whatever it was that they were assigned to. And if there is any issue with that, the RN will be held liable for any issues that developed with the work that aide did.
Okay, any other comments? Excellent comments. Okay, Helen?
Sorry, so we have two more short-term proposals. One of them Brian is going to do, which is based on proposal number 14.
Has that been handed out?
Yes. Handed out proposal 14 as of starting. This proposal would extend funding for outreach and education efforts currently taking place for the consumer-directed personal assistance program, targeting at helping populations who are underserved due to geography, culture, language, or other reasons. Basically, I think we identified among the charges of the this committee was addressing workforce shortages in different areas amongst different populations, and we feel that CDPAP is one of the most effective ways of doing this. That currently exists. We know that in several rural counties, home care, community-based care is primarily delivered through the consumer-directed program because adequate home care services, adequate personal care services don't exist. Unfortunately, what we're finding through a very limited effort this year is that there's tremendous amounts of varying degrees of understanding in both the consumer community as well as the healthcare professional community, those who do referrals, about the consumer-directed program. And that lack of understanding, that lack of knowledge about the program prevents the most effective usage of it and widespread usage of the program. So we think that this could be useful. We think that for a modest investment, a program that has been proven to be cost-effective could be put into wider use, saving states significant amounts of money
within the Medicaid program, and significant amounts of unnecessary hospital visits and nursing home placements. So.
Thank you. Any comments, questions?
So, Brian, the theory here is that with the investment of $500,000, whatever the amount is, did you put $500,000 in here? Then more people would take up the consumer-directed program, potentially in certain areas, and then by doing that and them enrolling in the program, the Medicaid program would actually save money? Because it seems to me like it would be an immediate cost to the Medicaid program, but I guess what you're saying is by allowing folks to stay in their home, they would avoid unnecessary hospitalizations and others. Is that the theory?
Right. I think there's two avenues. There's allowing people to stay in their homes who would go to nursing homes, who would wind up in the hospital. These are people who have a demonstrated need for some sort of services. If those needs aren't met, they will wind up in some sort of placement. If they're receiving care that does not meet their needs because of cultural issues, because of language issues, through a home care agency, through a personal care agency, then the transfer of that individual to a model of care that could more effectively meet their needs while at the same time proving generally more cost effective would save the state money as well.
You look like you're thinking, Tim. Any other comments or questions? Okay, so we'll put this through the L5 process. Helen, anything else?
There's one more proposal.
Okay.
Which Audrey is going to present, which is a combination of proposals 33 and 26.
Thank you. This was passed out earlier, and if you also have a paper clip, just so that you organize your papers, it is related to but not the same as proposal number 18A that was submitted by NEASA. So just to clean up your papers a bit. This builds on the proposals you've already heard this morning and creates senior CNA certification within the nursing home sector itself. It would specifically outline the minimum training and certification requirements with the understanding that the CNA would be able to undertake additional responsibilities, including but not limited to dispensing pre-poured medications and applying simple dressings and treatments in the skilled nursing facilities. This builds on the experiences in 20 other states that have allowed CNAs to administer medications in nursing homes. And in New York State, unlicensed direct care staff are allowed to administer meds for the OMRDD population, and we think that this can serve as a model. We believe that this will enhance the ability to provide cost-effective care, and specifically will allow the nursing staff and the RNs additional time to do the requisite patient assessment and care and for everybody to be able to participate in the healthcare teams more effectively. We also think that from the CNA perspective, this will provide a career ladder, which will ultimately lead to greater job satisfaction and improved work retention, which we know is also a cost to the system. We recognize that with doing this, there would need to be additional protocols and policies and PI within the nursing homes to make sure that this was all done safely.
Okay. Comments? Questions?
I'm on this subgroup, and we all supported this proposal, but I just want to really underline one of the things that Audrey said, which is that from the viewpoint of the Training and Employment Fund, medication should be only one of the components of a senior CNA. In other words, that when we looked at a senior home care worker,
they were going to get communication skills, problem-solving skills, et cetera, in addition to the meds. And we think that there's really a need for an advanced CNA, and that, for example, the CNA certification doesn't include psychosocial understanding, Alzheimer's, dementia, aging. It's more medically oriented. And I just would like to emphasize that I think that the senior aide, to really, by the way, be part of a real career ladder, needs to be more all-encompassing than just medication. I've seen a lot of people shaking their heads. Thank you.
Tina?
I have concerns about AIDS passing medications to non-self-directed clients for many reasons, not the least of which is the limited number of hours that it's required to have an RN on site in nursing homes. Currently, it's 8 hours. In many facilities, the 8 hours has become the ceiling rather than the floor, depending on the size of the facility, the number of aides that RN would be responsible for, in my opinion, would be exceedingly unsafe. There's also issues of the technology that's available to support this type of a system in some of the nursing homes where there have been waivers. There's electronic medical records. There's electronic dispensing of medications. The medications come from the pharmacy already packaged and labeled. And unfortunately, those systems are not available in the majority of the nursing homes we have in the state. So I have concerns about this proposal.
And again, maybe those comments can be taken into consideration as we move forward. Nothing's approved or not approved. We're going to put it through a process. But to the degree that some of those issues can be addressed going forward, that would be an improvement. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
Mike Chuck. We represent nursing aides in the public nursing homes, and if the additional duties and responsibilities are added on to them, that would have an impact, and we would have to bargain over the impact of that. So while there may be a cost savings on taking from the RNs, there would be a cost factor for nurse aides doing additional duties.
Is that addressed in the proposal?
We can certainly add it to the cost section to make that clear. It's not explicit, I don't think, right now.
Yes, Joy.
Thank you. And my comment would be neither in support nor objection. It would simply be raising the question that as you move forward through this process to address the safety concerns, which are significant, the aid nurse ratio, the technologies that are in use, if it's possible or feasible, what's the cost about bringing those technologies to the nursing homes? Because, you know, those technologies do reduce errors. So is the upfront cost to bring in the technology outweighing the risk of the medication error? And then looking at the liability, you know, one of the big concerns, I think, for the registered nurses is the liability and the accountability, because when you're an unlicensed person, you're not. There's no mechanism for accountability. So to look at ways to make there be a real sense of accountability, cost, quality, and to look at the other states. How are they managing this in the states that are doing it? Because maybe they're doing a terrific job, and we don't need to worry so much, but just to really examine all of the variables in place. Thanks.
Point. Anything else then about this? Okay. Is that it, Helen?
That's all our proposals.
Brilliant. I want to thank all the members of that subgroup for.
Could I just make a general comment? I think, except for the education and outreach program, I think all of these proposals really require statutory change, and I think to try to do them without statutory change would, if nothing else, invite litigation.
I think one of the on the form the proponents were to indicate what type of actions would be necessary, whether statutory or otherwise. So that all has to be should be in there.
And that's something that the members may want to take into consideration as well. You know, when they're doing their modified Delphi, you know, some of this will require statutory change, and that, you know, is going to be a heavier lift, frankly, in that regard. But that said, it's something that is part of the templated process.
And again, so when we call something short-term in what sense? So obviously we know that many of the proposals that are on the table, and we'll find, you know, others as well coming up later on, you know, even if it gets through this process, it has many roads to still go down and hurdles to overcome. But nevertheless, this is, I feel, the charge of our committee, and we're moving it forward, and at least it gets it to that place. What happens, you know, after that, you know, will be, I guess, related to the MRT, how it's followed up, and a whole variety of things, which I don't think we're really clear about. But I think a lot of proposals are going to fall into that category, and we haven't restricted ourselves not to, because it was actually, you know, even part of the form that might be necessary. So we know there's long ways to go with any of them, even if they were, you know, unanimously approved and so forth. It doesn't make it happen.
Did you say that the stackable credentials would also require a statutory change? Because I always thought that was really done through, you know, for right now, if an agency wants to modify the home health aid curriculum, they go to the Department of Health, and the Department of Health has the authority to approve that. So I didn't think that was something that required a legislative change.
I think that's probably correct. I was, I guess, thinking more about the proposals that interact with the nursing scope of practice.
Thank you.
Yeah. We finished the first subgroup, but there were some other, and I see we talked about it last night, or yesterday afternoon, but it's not on the agenda. But we talked about there was the whole grouping of proposals that we put into the other category, and the Department of Health staff was looking at that. And from that, there were a couple of proposals that we wanted to have be considered as well, that they would be able to present at this time. Barry, would you take the lead on that?
I'll try. Thank you. Yes, as Bill mentioned, DOH staff was asked to look at the roughly 30 proposals that were included in the other category, and that's the third set of recommendations on that spreadsheet. Again, they really neither fell into the licensed professional category or unlicensed worker category. Some of them weren't even necessarily scope of practice oriented. So anyway, we did our best, but I'll just do a real quick rundown. Basically, we felt these fell out into roughly 9 categories. We identified 5 that were reimbursement payment oriented that we thought we might refer to the payment MRT. Those included proposals 18, 49, 61, 6, and 78. And if it would be helpful, I'll just give like one example of each. It'd take about 15 seconds. I can't go through all 30 proposals, obviously, but maybe if I just give an example. Proposal number 61, the sponsor suggested raising pay levels for primary care physicians. Obviously, a reimbursement a payment issue. We identified 2 proposals that we thought were GME related. Those would include spreadsheet item numbers 86 and 87. Number 86, for example, the sponsor suggested that we look into adjusting medical school criteria to consider more non-academic criteria. The next category we looked at were provider incentives. We only found one in this category. And again, the example would be item number 82, which the sponsor suggested addressing shortages of child psychiatrists. We one of the probably the largest category of proposals that we identified, we called them principals. We thought that this this group may be interested in adopting or discussing a group of principles or items that we might want to include in a preamble to whatever report that we draft. We identified seven items under this category, and they include items number 7, 50, 5, 36, 51, 11, and number 62. An example of our principal category would be item number 50, where the sponsor had suggested that all proposals must consider the impact on patient safety, and that's obviously an item that has been mentioned several times as Helen's group went through their proposals. We've also we also identified five that we felt were closely related or already covered by some of the other by one of the two subgroups. And those, we were suggesting they be referred back, or they've already been referred back or incorporated into the subgroup's purview. Those included items number 71, 31, 56, 60, and 63. Let's see. An example of a refer back would be item number 71, where the sponsor requested that that we clarify the position of supervisors of dental hygienists. And I think there's going to be a discussion of several proposals over the next couple hours to deal with dental hygienists and that issue. There were several items. I skipped over one category. There were several items that we weren't exactly sure where they would fall, but we thought they certainly needed further study. There were six items in that category for further study. They included items 3, 21, 24, I'm sorry, 3, 22, thank you, Caleb, 24, 32, 29, and 52. An example of an item falling in that category would be the establishment of funding sources to support the training of laid-off workers. And actually, I think 3 of the 6 items were related to establishing a funding mechanism to help train laid-off workers. We identified one item that we thought was a little too broad-based to otherwise classify. That was item number 4, which was to incorporate any issues from the Health Workforce Development Subcommittee's report that the Departments of Health and the Departments of Labor have been working on, and I think which was shared with the subcommittee, that were not raised by this MRT. And a lot of the items that were recommended and that particular report have been addressed by, or are being addressed by this MRT. That left us with a couple of recommendations that we thought, and this group had suggested that we move forward with. The first was recommendation number 8, which was, develop a process and structure for the objective assessment of all proposed scope of practice changes. We're going to be talking a little bit more about that, I believe, in a few minutes. And there was another recommendation, I believe it was item number 37, that talks about expanding provider incentives. I think it mentioned the Doctors Across New York program, but it also mentioned other incentive loan repayment programs. So I believe Caleb is going to be presenting a proposal about the development of a primary care service core loan repayment program for clinicians. And again, I believe Caleb's going to be talking about that in a few minutes. So I know that's a very quick overview. It's very hard to digest. You've got the spreadsheet in front of you. But if you've got any questions, I can attempt to answer them.
Okay, if there are no questions, then about that, shall we get to the proposals themselves? So there are two proposals that come out of this. One is the this advisory group, and the other is the loan forgiveness program. So why don't you go ahead and present those as proposals?
Okay. Did you pass them out? As I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, the first proposal is proposal number 8, which would develop a process and structure for the objective assessment of all scope of practice changes. This was actually originally suggested by Gene Moore from the Center for Health Workforce Studies, but we've also had 4 or 5 other organizations that have suggested similar or related ideas. For instance, the State Medical Society recently, I think as recent as yesterday, proposed a very similar idea. I believe this is also related to the State Education Department's proposal that all MRT initiatives must consider their impact on patient safety. It's also related to SUNY's proposal to solidify a robust structure for health workforce data collection, and also Haney's idea to consider experience and the impact on the delivery system of elevating threshold educational requirements. Just a little bit about the proposal itself. The problem, as we've all been finding out over the past month, and most of you who have been dealing this with for many years, is we really don't have enough data and objective information to adequately assess scope of practice issues. We often do not adequately assess technical and quality of care issues. Our decision-making process is somewhat fragmented, and this leaves lawmakers, state agencies, licensing boards without enough objective information to make informed decisions. Anyway, we've suggested, or others have actually suggested, the creation of a voluntary, independent advisory committee, which would establish a formal process to objectively evaluate proposed changes to healthcare scope of practice laws, rules, regulations, and policy. The committee would be advisory only. It would not usurp any authority, which is currently maintained by the State Education Department or the various boards which oversee professional licensing and scope of practice. It could include representatives from various state agencies, such as the Department of Health, Department of Labor, State Education Department, Office of Mental Health, as well as industry representatives and consumers. So anyway, that's the nutshell of the proposal. Again, it seemed to be a lot of support from both of the subgroups. I know it needs a little bit more fleshing out.
Thanks, Barry. So I wanted to say a few things about that, then open it up. Now, I think this is very important. You know, having had the experience of working in our licensed professional scope of practice, and this is the charge of our group, whether like it or not, so all of a sudden becoming involved in many of the scope of practice issues that you'll be hearing something about in the afternoon, and, you know, then, you know, realizing we have a great resource in New York State in Gene Moore and the New York State Center of Health Workforce Studies that produce very impartial type of reports, and that's a resource to be considered. Whether we have the data or don't have the data, we certainly have conflicting views of the data. Some people might say we have the evidence and some people don't, but there, you know, an outside person, you know, doesn't have a really way to judge that, you know. So this would create some sort of impartial forum, really, through scientific or more rational type of approach to some of these issues. It's not going to solve them. It's not going to usurp anybody's authority. It's not going to do that, but it might provide a certain, you know, move the conversation forward a little bit, because other than that, we're locked in. This stakeholder group says this, and that stakeholder does that, and so forth. So it's not making a judgment about the quality of the data one way or another. It's trying to, and this cuts across so many professions. And we know, I think, that in order to go forward with health reform, things like this will have to be addressed. Okay, and it's an important part of going forward somehow. Even the modest proposals, you know, bring out the in my opinion, this issue. So I would love to do this. It doesn't hurt anything. Right now, I know this is just the very first draft, and it can be improved and brought forward. But it's something, a resource that we might be able to have in the state as we go forward. It's not meant to delay something or not delay something, but it is to develop a resource that we can have in the state that might provide some impartial academic or scientific or reasoned approaches to some of these things that might be able to inform the decision makers in the state. So I'm very much in favor of it, and just want to say that. Any other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
First, not a question, but an observation. Where it says voluntary, I assume that means unpaid. Whoever wants to be on it, raise your hand. And the word independent is always nice. I'm still waiting to meet the first independent person. My two questions are, number one, who would appoint the members of this body?
I don't speak for Barry, but I mean, people have talked, I think all this is up for consideration. How do we create the most, you know, how should it be created? Who mm-hmm. should create it? Under what, you know, aegis, and who should be on it? And I know we at least have been discussing representation from some of the key state agencies, and to get as close to independence as we can. So I'm coming from academia, I'm thinking some academics, you know, or certainly not partisan, you know, highly partisan folks. On the other hand, you know, so I think that would be the kind of thing we have to get into here to really, can we create as independent and as impartial body as we possibly can, properly positioned in the state to provide a resource to the people who will be making the decisions, rather than the just back and forth, which is what we hear at, you know, what we experience in some of the subgroups and issues here.
And my other question is, do we know of any state that has created such a thing and has it been useful?
Yeah, I think we're sort of just at the beginning of that. I believe Virginia, and we were looking at various models in various California. Nothing, of course, is exactly the same, here for a variety of reasons, but I think that's part of the research here, to look at what has been created, is it working as possible models, and I know I've tried to find some, and I've looked at it, you know, kind of briefly, but I think others have looked into it as well. I know, Barry, you were doing a little bit of that.
We really just began to do some research, and we did look at four or five states, New Mexico, Iowa, Virginia, some of them were statutorily created. We basically relied on a paper that Catherine Dower from the University of California, San Francisco, wrote, and then we also looked a little bit at some of the work that Gene Moore had done. But again, we really just have begun to do that research.
Yes, Debbie.
So I have a comment and a question. How would this proposal relate to the things that we want to act on that we have put on the short list? Because we haven't heard the scope of practice reports yet, but I know we're hearing that possibly the ones from our work group might require some statutory change and might deal with it. I thought that we were very much instructed that we needed to move certain issues here. So I'm just wondering how you see creating this body impacting on our ability to move fast is number one. And then number two is, it seems to me that there are really two separate issues, and that this proposal doesn't address an issue that I think is crucial, and that the work group that I chaired under the HRSA grant really emphasized, which is that we need to fund the Center for the Study of the Healthcare Workforce and possibly expand the role to look at these quality issues. And to me, data is not mentioned here. And data is really, really important. And this is something that we have a resource, and it has been under-resourced in the last session of legislature. So that I think we need that information, regardless of whether we have this committee. So, by the way, I want to say I think that the idea of establishing a more rational process would be good. I'm just concerned that it not hold up certain things that we're mandated to work on in this MRT.
This is my opinion on that. Yeah, this isn't meant to hold up anything, you know, at all. But we do know, or even from the proposals we've seen and others, that there will be, like it or not, and necessarily a somewhat of a long time frame in moving forward, even while we're pulling short-term proposals here. So, and again, this is just a first iteration. I think consultation and development, of taking all your points, would have to be considered as we fully develop the proposal over time. Joyce.
Thanks. Well, speaking as someone who has worked on legislation for my profession for more than 15 years, and I think that this is a great idea. I think it's always good to look at issues like this. However, the caveat I would offer is that I would never, never, never want to hear someone say to me, well, your bill hasn't gone to the advisory committee yet, so it's going to have to languish someplace. I would hate to see this become an analysis paralysis kind of thing, or, well, we'll just hold it in that committee until all those nurse practitioners go to the nursing home. It would be very important for those of us who have bills out there know that our bills will keep moving through the process even as they are being examined. That's my
Bob Houston, Medical Society. I'm certainly comfortable subjugating our recommendation here under this recommendation.
Given that the non-licensed group had several proposals that are I guess not going to be going forward because they're considered long-term, meaning not ready for prime time. Since this proposal, it's not clear who would be appointing the body, and it's not clear yet whether other states have found such bodies useful. Is this ready for prime time?
Well, we're here today, and we have till 7th of November, I believe. So I don't know. It's a new idea, and you know what our time frame is into this. So I guess that's to be seen. You know, come the day when we really have to make a final decision on really all of them, to a certain extent. But so that would be my take on that. David and then Brian.
I just want to echo mostly what Joyce said. This proposal seems to me to add
add an additional layer of process rather than streamlining process, because it's not eliminating legislative oversight or the process of anything that goes on currently, but adding yet another potential place to be stuck waiting for somebody to add yet another bill onto their docket to move through. You know, it already goes through council, it goes through the first committee once the bill even exists. So I'm not sure where the streamlining benefits are going to come.
So I guess as these comments are taken, you know, it's not meant to be some sort of additional roadblock at all, but I could see, you know, okay, other comments?
I was just commenting on, I mean, I think it would help me anyway make decisions, you know, a lot of the things on impact on stakeholders and the implementation timeline. I think especially the implementation timeline would be helpful in making decisions and doing the
I know we heard because Gene Moore, who is really a proponent of this, is in Australia, so I must have, you know, I have to give credit to Farmers. I think they put this together last night, and it didn't really have a champion, so we were, you know, sort of laying back a little
back.
We certainly hope so. And again, just echoing, you know, we have some resources here. We have to figure out how to use them in the best way, so they're not an impediment, but it's something that's an enhancement.
And I did speak to Gene Moore last night, and she did review the proposal. She was supportive of it, and she certainly was more than willing to help flush this out a little more and put some meat on it, because I recognize there are some holes with this.
I'm more than happy to champion. I think that it's very important. The state has an agenda right now on patient-centered medical homes, on health homes that are moving forward. I don't think we have a good sense as those programs start to get implemented and the state starts to shift the entire healthcare system to a completely different paradigm where the scope of practice issues are getting in the way of the most effective delivery of those care models. So I think this, with that focus, is incredibly important.
I just want to mention that there's actually exciting new data coming out. Over the last year, many of the insurers are now actually getting provider-specific, and they're assigning provider numbers to mid-level and physicians. Up until now, that has not been the case. And in fact, one of the large groups is even now asking physicians to register as mid-level. So I think it exemplifies that there is really an awful lot of data out there that we don't have that we will be getting very soon. And
any other comments? Debbie?
Yeah, but kind of wanting to reiterate that I think that short term, we definitely could come up with data needs that we don't now have, which could inform a lot of our decisions, and I think that that's more straightforward to say that we want to be getting this data and then to be on the longer term, but again, I would think the longer term could be like our committee suggested by the fall of 2012, looking at this scope of practice issue. But I think it's essential. I think that we're missing a lot of data to make decisions, and as I said, I'm concerned that we had a resource and that resource has gotten less funding. So, to me, that's something that's just a no-brainer that we ought to address in the short term.
Okay. Any other comments about this? Tina?
Yeah, I want to piggyback on what Deb was just saying. I think there certainly is a need for quality information. There's a need for impact information and the technical information that Gene is proposing here. However, I do not believe that some of the proposals that are coming before this body now don't have that stuff attached to it. I believe that they do. I believe that some people don't like what's there, and that's certainly part of the debate and the discussion that we'll be having, but I really don't want to see anything held up in terms of going forward or what are we spending all of our time doing. You know, we might as well cancel the rest, in my opinion, cancel the rest of the meeting if we're not going to discuss the scope related
That's why.
This particular proposal is another proposal. Every proposal is going forward with whatever, for better or worse, the process that we've established, and I don't see it having any impact on, you know, actual proposals coming out of this group. It's just at this point, it's a first idea, first iteration of something. And we have a deadline by November, whatever it is, so it's not possible to impact that. Okay, anything else on this one? One more, another proposal about the loan repayment, I believe.
Right. This is...
This is Karen Coleman on the line. I don't know if anyone else is experiencing the same issue, but there's a problem now with the line, not only a lot of static, but the voice goes in on very low where you can't hear and then up. So I'm going to redial in because I don't know if it's my phone or the phone in general.
No, it's not your
problem.
Everybody's having the same problem on the phone, so redialing in, I think, will make a difference.
Okay, I just didn't know. Thank you.
It may be related that people aren't speaking directly into the microphone, perhaps, so we'll try to do a better job here on that. Okay. Caleb.
This is Proposal 37. It's basically, I would call it a riff on what Haney's originally came out with. It kind of focuses on the incentive programs and the expansion are the kind of words we teased out of it to get to this proposal. The Primary Care Service Corps is a new program, and it would basically aim to increase the supply of non-physician clinicians that are practicing in primary care in federally designated underserved areas. They're called, for those of you who know, they're called HPSAs. We specifically would exclude physicians from this program because we already have the Doctors Across New York program, which the loan repayment is still funded at $1.7 million annually, and the practice support is about $4 million annually, and these are continuing to be funded. But related to the Primary Care Service Corps, qualifying physicians could get up to $60,000 for the first 2 years of service. It would be an initial 2-year contract that could be either for a part-time or a full-time commitment. Clinician is what I meant, right? Sorry about that. $30,000 for a part-time commitment, and any additional years that they would put in would receive $35,000 a year for years 3 and 4, and then $25,000 for any additional years after that, for which qualifying educational loan amounts still exist, and for which obviously the clinician is still eligible and in a eligible position. The good thing about this is that the National Health Service Corps exists out there, and the state of New York has really never taken advantage of the leverage possibilities of its state loan repayment program, which currently allows a federal match for a loan repayment program similar to the National Health Service Corps for non-physicians as well as non-physician clinicians. And so if we were to devote about $500,000 a year in state funding, that could be doubled, basically, for a total of $1 million. And depending upon qualifying educational debt, this program could actually provide an additional 33 or so clinicians, at least in the initial first 2 years of the contract, with and additional clinicians could be included if the legislature added to the funding. So we feel this is justified because I think everybody agrees that demand for primary care is going to be rising in light of the federal health care reform and the addition, in our view, about 1 million people on the insurance rolls in the next few years. And so this seems like to us a no-brainer as a way to increase primary care services in underserved areas. We believe it would save money, obviously, by the general algorithm is the more primary care you get, the less people wait and the more access they have for primary care, the less they wait and end up in an ER and very much more expensive modes of care. So if this is enacted as a short-term proposal, we could probably get it in the 12-13 budget, and that means without too much trouble, the first contract would start probably in October, about a year from now. So, any questions or comments?
Thank you.
Yeah. I have a comment. Hi, Joy Elwell. This is an excellent idea. I know that this is already being done in the Commonwealth of Virginia and is working very effectively. I can tell you that programs like this exist in private industry, if you want to call universities private industry. Personally, when I was being educated as a nurse practitioner in 1990, I taught for Pace University and was able to enjoy half tuition. Kind of similar model. It wasn't after the fact. It was during the fact. Many universities do offer this to master's-level nurses who are going for their nurse practitioner and nurse midwifery education. It works. It saves money. It provides more clinicians.
Other comments?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I think it's a terrific idea. It would be wonderful if we can get the governor to put this in the budget. My only suggestion is to consider adding dentists to the list.
Well, that would be certainly a possibility because, again, we could get that federal match for dentists as well as dental hygienists.
So many of the state initiatives around expanding access to primary care and enhancing the quality of primary care with the patient-centered medical home and the health home are trying to get primary care practices to be better equipped to deal with the range of depression, underdiagnosed depression, and the other behavioral health issues that so often travel with the chronic illnesses. And I just wonder whether a psychiatric nurse practitioner could be part of this as well?
Yes.
I want to support the idea of adding dentists to this suggestion. This is Tom Curran. Add my name to that, please.
Was that for dentists, did you say?
Yeah, to include dentists in the program.
Okay.
We have rural areas that are unbelievably short of manpower.
Okay, thank you. Tim.
Can I just ask you, you say that this program, the state funding could be matched through the National Health Service Corps, but I'm assuming that is not the case with the Doctors Across New York program?
It is the case for Doctors Across New York. It was not the case for the first cycle, because making your eyeballs glaze over, there were some differences between the federal program and the state program, such that the state program was less stringent in its requirements, thus obviating the ability of the state to match federal funds. But we could apply state loan repayment program funds to Doctors Across New York as well, but it would only be for those who are in primary care and serving in health professional shortage areas for primary care. So if we were to match the 41 currently in the Doctors Across New York program, if we could, I estimate we could have probably leveraged an additional $200,000.
So I just want to understand this. Are you saying that you're going to do that going forward?
Yes.
So that doesn't need to be a proposal.
Right. Cycle two, we actually were able to change the legislation. So it had to do with the default criteria. And the default criteria in the first cycle was really not as stringent as the federal because the feds basically changed their definition in the middle of the game and we weren't able to match it.
Yes, Bob.
This also sounds like a really good idea to me. Private practicing and small business physicians and dentists have been very much disenfranchised by the current systems and models, and this could potentially re-engage that population of physicians and dentists who practice in just a local small group. So we'd like that for that reason.
Joy.
And I heard you say dental hygienists. But since Mary Ellen isn't here, I just would like to, if it has not already been included, that the dental hygienists be included in this, if that is possible, because they are the ones who are bringing primary care dentistry to many Medicaid children.
Right. We can match the funds with anyone who's eligible under the National Health Service Corps, and dental hygienists are, in fact, eligible.
Wow. Great. Tina.
Yeah, I would really support this. I know in looking back, because we just recently done it, at some of the National Service Corps projects in the 60s, particularly around the issue of psychiatric clinical nurse specialists, there was a tremendous increase, obviously, when there was this funding, and I would hope that we'd have see the same results with primary care.
Yes.
This is Mara Dolan, DC 37. Of course, I support this increasing access to care, especially in underserved areas. This appears to be dealing with license provider issues, which we haven't even gotten to yet. And while I'm glad to see there are identified funds, I would ask that you all keep in mind the funding that in 3 and 22, there needs to be funding for the training and development of non-licensed providers in order to transition people into those areas. And I'm pleased that Assemblymember Gottfried is here because, you know, we're going to need the legislature's help to get funding, whether it's through the millionaire's tax or some other funding source. Thank you.
Any other comments? Okay. Really sounds like a keeper. Maybe this is a good time for a break. Do we know if the food is here? I remember lunch here. If not, we'll continue, but let's make sure that it's here. And so we're going to take a – well, if the food is here, we'll take a little break for lunch. We still have a lot to go, you know, for the afternoon and a lot of proposals to go through. So it's a very full agenda. So have to come back hopefully quickly after lunch and
Bill, do you want the people online to call back in, and if so, what time?
We'll know soon. Hold on a second. Okay. Okay, so the lunch isn't here yet. I'm glad I asked. I remember from last time. The suggestion was that perhaps we move to the discussion and adoption of charge. And what could you tell me out on that in terms of what we have to discuss? And
I think I think it's pro forma. It's just that the group hadn't officially adopted its charge. We just need to, have this group adopt that charge, because that is one thing that, it's been the rubric for the work that you've been doing, the framework for your work. So we just need to have the work group just.
So that was the original charge that we passed out in originally.
Yeah.
I don't have a copy in front of me right now, but, so let me just ask, maybe it'll be easier. Is everyone, we want to discuss or adopt the charge as was presented originally for the group in our first meeting? Does anybody have any issues or problems with that, or do people feel they want to see it again? Hold on a second. Okay. How difficult would it be to get a copy of these? Let's get a copy and get it in front of us, and then.
I'm prepared to just agree to it, given where we are in this process. Honestly.
All right. Well then, I'll read it. I don't know. George, you want to try it? No. George only had 2 hours sleep, so we're kind of okay. I'm going to try to do this without. Okay, workforce flexibility, change of scope of practice. We've had some people question the title of that, but that's the title, and we're not going to change that. This work group will develop a multi-year strategy to redefine and develop the workforce to ensure that the comprehensive healthcare needs of New York's population are met in the future. I'm going to editorialize it just a drop, but I see that advisory board that we talked about as being able to address this multi-year strategy, or possibly. So it's at least something
that we have that is, you know, could perhaps address that point. Sorry about that. The proposed strategy will include redefining the roles of certain types of providers and aligning training and certification requirements with workforce development goals. The objective will be to formulate consensus recommendations and identify areas in statute, regulation, and policy that would require changes in order to implement them. The work group will consider proposals for implementation in funding year 2012-2013 that would increase workforce flexibility, including those outlined in MRT number 200. The goal should be to create a consensus product that both builds and redefines the workforce to allow New York to ensure that the comprehensive health care needs of our population are met in the future. The work group will discuss implementation of changes in healthcare settings outside the long-term care sector, as well as changes to the scope of practice of advanced practice clinicians in all settings. This work is related to MRT recommendation number 200, change in scope of practice for mid-level providers to promote efficiency and lower Medicaid costs. Workgroup membership will include representatives of the State Education Department, the New York State Nurses Association, and other interested stakeholders. Smaller groups within this work group will focus on several issues. One, permit nurses under the scope of practice exemption to orient and direct home health aides and personal care workers to provide nursing care as is currently allowed in the Consumer Directed Personal Assistance Program. Allow licensed practical nurses, LPNs, to complete assessments in long-term care settings. Extend the use of medication aides into nursing homes. Expand the scope of practice of home health aides to include the administration of pre-poured medications to both self-directing and non-self-directing individuals. And expand the scope of practice to allow dental hygienists to address the need for services in underserved areas. So that is our charge. Can I have any comments? Catherine.
I'd like to ask a question. What does consensus mean?
Okay, that's been an important topic of discussion, but I'm going to have to throw that one over to Karen.
Part of the purpose for doing the Delphi tool is to get to the prioritizations of this committee, and then that conversation is going to need to be had, frankly, at that November 7th meeting. So I think hopefully you'll be able to make informed decisions based on the information that comes from this group as a whole. So that's our attempt to try to give you information that represents the respective viewpoints of the individuals at this table.
Is that yes,
I'd like to suggest editorial change, if I may. Bullet number 5, where the work group will discuss implementation. I think it's a little clearer if it says the work group will discuss the consequences of implementation of changes.
The work group will discuss consequences of implementation of changes. What are people's views about that?
Maybe I'd like the word impact better than consequences. Consequences sounds a little negative. Impact might be a little more positive.
Any other comments?
Or you could just take out the words implementation of and just say we'll discuss changes.
Any other suggestions? Since we haven't taken a vote on anything, I'm not sure how to proceed a little bit. We haven't got to that point, and I've been dreading it. Anyway, well, how about any other comments about this? Are there any things we have to consider in changing a charge or no? How about I'm going to suggest we go with the suggestion that we just go with changes, since it seems more sort of neutral, I guess. How do people feel about that?
Good.
Anybody have any problem with that? Okay, we did it. Thank you. We definitely have consensus.
That bodes well for the session.
Okay, we're taking out implementation of, and we're just going with changes. Thank you all very much. Okay, so we just accomplished another job. Let me ask for some advice. Do we want to take a break, a bathroom break? Do we want to, let's do that. Yeah, so why don't we just take a break, you still know when the food will be coming, Barry, I guess?
No, they just said flight delay. They couldn't give me a time.
Okay, let's take a 15-minute break. I mean, if food isn't here yet, I guess we have to get back and get back to work. But if the food is here, we can break a little longer. Okay, thank you. Don't go too far.
Hey, Bill, what's the answer to? Do you want to?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Wanted
me to give you the answer about the call-in. Does anybody have? This is the question: should people call? When should people call back in? Okay, we're going to take a chance that the food will be delivered. We're going to start again at 12:30. Let's put it that way. Is that what you're saying? Why don't you call in again at 12:30, and let's hope that works. Okay.
In 15 minutes.
So that's just for the break, yeah. Oh, hold on a second, I'm sorry. It sounds like an easy question, doesn't it? But it's a little more complicated.
Bill, I'll tell you what, I'll stay on the line until 12:30, and then you'll tell me if you...
You know, we really don't know for sure, so maybe you could just stay on the line.
I'll stay on the line.
Oh, hold on, we may have a good suggestion, let's see.
What if we come back at 12:30?
It isn't worth it for 15 minutes. I'll stay.
We're not allowed to eat in this room. I would say stay on the line. Try to stay on the line if you can.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm sorry about lack of clarity.